Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Cost containment of health care in the United States is really everyone's problem. Today we're going to talk about diabetes. The American Diabetes Association estimates that the total national cost of diagnosed diabetes in the United States is around $245 billion, that's with a B, dollars per year. That's roughly the equivalent to the annual cost of all workplace injuries and illnesses in the United States. And it should be pointed out that a considerable portion of at least type 2 diabetes is preventable. On this program, we're going to discuss the state of Alaska's diabetes prevention programs with Aaron Widener. Aaron is a head coordinator for the diabetes prevention program for the Anchorage YMCA. She also has a daughter with type 1 diabetes, which she's been helped manage for about 8 years. Also with us in the studio is Leslie Shallcross. She is a registered dietitian and nutritionist, an associate professor of extension. I've got down youth, family, and community development for the University of Alaska.
That works.
Fairbanks School of Natural Resources and Extension. And in addition, she has 10 years of health promotion and disease prevention experience.
We're 30.
30, okay.
10 with UAF.
10 with UAF. I'm sorry about that. Let me remind everybody as we get into the program, if you would like to reach us with questions or comments about diabetes, this is how you can do that. You can call us directly at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell out the line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line one at alaskapublic.org. Aaron, Leslie, welcome to line one. It's the first
Thank
time
you.
For both of
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start with the basics. That's what I usually do, some definitions and so forth. So what's diabetes? What's type 1? What's type 2? What's the difference? Go for it,
Go
Leslie.
Go for it. Okay. Well, type 1 diabetes usually is something that starts in early childhood. Sometimes it emerges in very early adulthood, mm-hmm. but most often we diagnose it in early childhood or even a two-year-old. And in that case, the pancreas, which produces insulin, is usually destroyed. Probably an autoimmune or infection, creating some immune response and destruction of the pancreas has occurred, and there's virtually no insulin being produced. Someone with type 1 diabetes must take insulin in order to survive, in order to use glucose for energy.
And no amount of exercise or diet will change that for them.
Right. So then type 2 diabetes, in recent years, we've actually seen this also develop in young children, adolescents, but most often we associate type 2 diabetes with an onset in middle or late middle adult years. It is a situation in which the pancreas is still producing insulin, but insufficient amounts, or there is also a component of that that involves insulin resistance, meaning that the cells can't use the insulin. So there may be a defect in receptors that use the insulin. So people with type 2 can control their diabetes through diet, exercise, and also medications that can help to stimulate the pancreas to produce more insulin and also help with that insulin resistance.
Okay.
And that's our largest population as well, too. So, you know, if we're looking at 100% of diabetics, 95% of them are going to be type 2.
Right. And Leslie, you mentioned that type 1 is usually thought of as presenting in younger individuals, and often more acutely, the symptoms happen much more rapidly. And in you also, then you mentioned in type 2, it's happens to be more in elder or older individuals. And you didn't say it, but often the symptoms are a little bit more subtle and maybe present for a while. What I was going to get to is you said that we're seeing it maybe in younger populations, and so that begs mm-hmm. the question is why might that be?
You know, we don't know why people get diabetes, but we do know that that a number of things that are environmental, we would call them, physical inactivity and obesity or overweight, contribute to this insulin resistance. And that is probably why we're seeing it, because as we know, so much of our young population now is overweight, something we never mm-hmm. saw yeah. when I was young.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to expand on this idea of insulin resistance and maybe spend a little time on insulin. You guys correct me now if I'm wrong, but so insulin is made as a response to a meal, and it helps you get the sugar that is absorbed into your bloodstream into cells.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as you said, if we have an autoimmune problem like type 1 diabetes, where antibodies or the body, so to speak, you think of it, begins to destroy the cells in the pancreas that make insulin. We don't have insulin anymore. And before there was insulin, people didn't live very long with type 1 diabetes. They could do things with diet and maybe extend life a little bit, but eventually you succumb very early to problems. Now we have insulin, and we have fancier and fancier and better ways to monitor and use insulin, and that's improved things. With type 2, we have a situation where we have, in a sense, oftentimes insulin resistance, and what that means is the insulin we make does not respond well at the cellular level, and we can't get the glucose in, so the body gets the message, I got to make more and more and more insulin. In a sense, we burn out the pancreas in a sense. It kind of can't mm-hmm. keep up, and being obese is by itself an insulin-resistant state, mm-hmm. mm. and so a lot of the thought is that if we can control the weight issue and exercise, it makes insulin more efficient on the other side of the coin, helps insulin work better to get glucose into the cells.
Yes.
So hopefully that'll help everybody understand these two differences. But we haven't talked about symptoms, and mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about those briefly also. What are the primary, most cogent, most common symptoms of diabetes?
Well, you're going to see them a little bit in type 1 more. It's going to become more evident. I know with our daughter, it became she was urinating frequently. She mm-hmm. was drinking. Her thirst was insatiable. It didn't matter how much water we gave her. She was drinking it and then urinating a lot because of that. Losing weight was another factor as well. Lethargic. She was lethargic and fussy and cranky, very different than her normal personality. So some of those are very similar to type 2, but they show up differently. Some of the symptoms you may have is urinating more frequently, weight loss, feeling flu-like symptoms. The other one that people have said is their eyesight starts to go mm-hmm. bad. They have trouble seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then oftentimes they are told by their doctors, usually when it has to do with weight, you know, with blood tests and things like that will also show up there for them. And that's mm-hmm. just much more of a hard line to show them if they are pre-diabetic as well.
It's important that people do know, though, that the symptoms may be very, yeah. very subtle.
Very.
Especially with type mm-hmm. 2.
Yes. When you have type 2 as an adult, mm-hmm. you may not notice the symptoms or, you know, you just...
Sure.
But yeah, the frequent urination is one thing.
Being a little older than the average person now, I know that getting up and going to the bathroom has other causes.
Sure, correct. Right?
but we want I want to come back to that a little bit, and The way I think about diabetes to explain these symptoms is, again, insulin has got to get that sugar out of the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. It gets there through absorption through your intestines. All right, so now you got glucose in your bloodstream. It's got to get into the cells. If you don't have insulin or you got insulin resistant, doesn't matter, either one, now it can't get out. Your blood all gets filtered by your kidneys.
Right.
And your kidneys are going to take that extra glucose and spill it out. And you can measure extra glucose in the urine. However, you can't pee out molasses, so you're going to take water with that glucose. So it helps you understand you're not getting as much energy. You're peeing because you've got to get rid of that glucose, and then you're taking more water with you. So with type 1, it's pretty acute. Usually happens very quickly. Insulin really stops being made very, very fast, whereas in the type 2, it's often a little bit more subtle.
It could be years,
for people
to see it.
Not everyone with type 2 diabetes is overweight. There are probably, it's fair to say, there are different mechanisms by which type 2 comes on, but the vast majority of the increase in diabetes, is my understanding, seems to be related to obesity.
Yes.
Now, testing. All right, so now we're at type 2. Subtle, can last for a long time before we really know we've got anything going on, so it suggests maybe we ought to get some tests every once in a while. What kind of tests can we do?
You know, for a diagnosis of diabetes, usually you will have a glucose tolerance test that requires going to a laboratory or physician provider, medical provider's office, and having your system challenged with a drink of glucose.
Yeah. They do it to pregnant women a lot.
Same glucose
tolerance test is the standard by which you'd be tested. You can have random finger pokes to test your blood sugar levels, and if they're very, very high, we would be reasonably certain that person has diabetes. So that's hemoglobin A1C, which is another test that is being done more and more these days as a screening tool. So those tests.
Yeah, so the oral glucose tolerance test is basically a challenge to see how your body is going to use that glucose.
Yeah, usually you would be referred for a glucose tolerance test after you'd had a screening finger poke, a rapid glucose screening or a rapid hemoglobin A1C screening, and those were out of range.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot more people that are being referred to my program have more A1C testing done as a standard blood test. They're putting it in part of the standard, because it gives them a good picture.
Yeah, so let's explain that if we can. And so the oral glucose tolerance, you come in, you drink a standard amount of glucose, think 100 grams, and then 30 minutes, an hour, 3-4 hours, you really get some kind of idea how your body's handling the glucose. It's a little bit of a pain. You got to go and drink. So then the other test is the fasting glucose, which means you have to be in the morning. And if fasting glucose is over a certain amount, you're not handling that glucose well.
Sure.
But what makes hemoglobin A1C, which is only recently, in the last couple of years, I think, been accepted as a way to screen, it really gives you what we call an integrated, a idea of how much your glucose is abnormal over a prior three-month period of time.
Right. Yep.
And so that's becomes very convenient, can be drawn at any time. Doesn't matter whether you're eating or drinking or anything at that particular time. It gives you a pretty good idea.
Right. When you have a fasting glucose test or fasting blood sugar, it may not tell you what you need to know because a person may have diabetes or not usually, but a person may have diabetes or even pre-diabetes, and the fasting glucose test is not going to tell you what you need to know because maybe they didn't have much carbohydrate for the past 24 hours, and so their blood sugar levels will actually be in a normal range. So that's the hemoglobin A1C is a wonderful test.
Back to not to just slight the symptoms, so that the symptoms would be urinating more, particularly having to get up more at night, perhaps not gaining weight, even losing weight, particularly with type 2, a little bit more subtle.
Abnormally. Yeah. So it's going to be abnormal weight loss.
And we might start having some difficulties with vision. Sometimes if you're really into it, you can have some issues with some what we call paresthesias. You don't feel quite the right things, particularly on the lower, the longer nerves, those in your feet where you may begin to have some funny feelings or loose sensation in your feet. None of these by then all by themselves are absolutely diagnostic. As I've already said, there's a lot of other reasons why somebody may have to get up more in the middle of the night, like drinking more liquids or more coffee or having prostate problems in men or other urinary problems. So if you're having those kinds of symptoms, and you're older and you are a little bit overweight, it's pretty much a recommendation that you ought to be screened for diabetes.
Yes.
Before we go on, one of the things that's happened because of the screening, we've now established something called a pre-diabetes state, and I want to talk about that, but I want to remind listeners again that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and if you've got questions or comments about diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, particularly more than even type 2, the prevention of type 2, where it's where this program is heading, here's how you get a hold of us. You can dial 550-8433 during the next 45 minutes or so. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And an email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So we got these lines in the sand and three ways of testing. And if you are over those, then you probably have diabetes. And again, working with a physician, you may be able and should be able to establish pretty quickly whether this is type 1 or type 2. Type 1 generally, well, almost always has to be treated with insulin because your pancreas is not making it. Type 2, with diet, exercise, lifestyle manifestation changes, but sometimes even insulin in those individuals and or some medication. However, as we've proceeded along with these diagnostic categories, people have now identified a situation that's called pre-diabetes. Mm-hmm. Somebody want to help me understand what that's all about?
Yeah, well, pre-diabetes is definitely a situation of that insulin resistance that we were talking about. And we've been, because of our great awareness of diabetes, the great increase of diabetes in our population, we've reached to this prevention, and we know that if we can address the causes of the prediabetes or the causes of the insulin resistance through lifestyle management, those individuals may be able to avoid developing diabetes. Again, if you go to a health fair or your workplace has a screening, they may be doing the hemoglobin A1C screening, and someone who has a hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 to 6.4 is someone that we would say has prediabetes. Typically, someone with prediabetes also has a little bit higher BMI. Again, just like you mentioned with diabetes, some people are not overweight. Mm-hmm. Some people with prediabetes also aren't terribly heavy, but often they have perhaps more body fat. Mm-hmm. And so,
sedentary lifestyle.
Yep, the sedentary lifestyle, a BMI over 25.
Sure.
Those are individuals who should start thinking, I'm going to do something, because we know if we address those risk factors, you may avoid developing diabetes. On the other side, if you don't address the risk factors, if you have that high hemoglobin A1C and you don't address the risk factors, within 3 to 5 years, you are likely to have diabetes.
Yeah. Is that your understanding as well, Erin?
That's exactly it.
Yeah. For a long time, I don't see it as much now, but we went through a period where there was a lot of consternation in the media about the medicalization of our population with pre-diabetes, pre-depression, all these kinds of things. And the idea was that pharmaceutical companies are pushing this so that they can do more. But really, at least for this pre-diabetic state, it's my understanding, similar to the numbers that you gave us, that 50% of people who have that diagnosis of pre-diabetes within 10 years are going to clearly have diabetes. So this is a very high-risk situation and is kind of leading to where the rest of the program goes, because you can do something about this. Mm-hmm. If there's one message from today's program for type 2 diabetes, there is now pretty good evidence that a very high percentage of individuals that their tendency towards diabetes can be modified significantly. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal. 50% over 10 years who are pre-diabetic, and that's based on that hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 up to about 6.4, over 6.4, 6.5 and above is really felt to be a true diabetic state in testing. So what is the incidence? We talked a little bit before. How many people in the United States have diabetes? What percentage of them are type 2? Do we have an idea of just general numbers?
Oh, my. It changes every year. So I don't have the latest. What was the latest? From 2014?
Well, I know in pre-diabetes that 1 out of 3 adults mm-hmm. have pre-diabetes.
I've got something like 8% of adults have type 2 diabetes.
And right.
We get out there at nearly 30 million people have diabetes, 86, mm-hmm. Another 86 have pre-diabetes. So these are big numbers. We're, 300 and some odd million people. So a very mm-hmm. high percentage, high cost, as I kind of implied at the beginning of the program. If we're spending a lot of money on all these things, we don't have money for education, we don't have money for infrastructure, we don't have a number of money for social programs. So at least the medical establishment is well aware of the cost, and anybody who's buying insurance in Alaska knows that there's a cost. But the medical community can't get everybody to control their weight as much as we would love to. So we all need to begin to understand the consequences of this weight.
Absolutely.
We've talked about some of the risk factors of being overweight and not being active. Are there other risk factors that jump out or you guys think about off the top of your head? You mentioned pregnancy earlier. I think women who have had very large babies or have gestational diabetes are at somewhat of a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes as well.
Sure. And as we age, too, I mean, over the age of 45, our risk goes up a little bit. 65, even more significant.
There are some other genetic indicators as well, and I don't want to spend too much time. There's a lot of women, a significant number of women have polycystic ovarian disease. If they have that, there are certain illnesses like that that also increase insulin resistance and put them at somewhat risk. And I suspect if they've had that diagnosis, they're well aware of that. So we know a lot about diabetes. We know how it develops. We are seeing an increase, a dramatic increase in the amount of diabetes. We know how to identify a state before you become overtly diabetic, type 2 diabetes. And then there were some studies looking at can anything be done to prevent that? And that has kind of led to the Diabetes Prevention Program. So somebody want to tell me about that study or the studies that have indicated some lifestyle changes can have a significant impact?
Well, sure. As Leslie mentioned earlier, some of the studies are showing significant amount of with their weight loss and also increasing their physical activity, that they're showing a significant drop in people that are being diagnosed with type 2. So 58% under the age of 60. If they are on this program, and this is a lifestyle change program. It is not a quick fix by any means. It is a long and hard work, but it definitely makes a big difference. I know people going through our program that have dropped their A1C significantly through it. So they're pretty radical changes. I mean, even metformin isn't. I think that they're only 30% or so change, and this is in the almost 60 and 70% over the age of 60 mm-hmm. that we're seeing these people not become type 2 diabetics.
So what I'd like to do now, Aaron and Leslie, is take our usual break. We're going to take about a one-minute break and come back and really focus some more on what can be done to prevent the onset of type 2 diabetes. And I think it's probably also fair to say, even if you have type 2 diabetes, these changes can dramatically improve your ability to control the outcome of that disease.
Absolutely.
As well. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number, again, is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we'll continue our discussion of diabetes prevention programs with Aaron Widener and Leslie Shallcross. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Aaron Widener of the Anchorage YMCA, where she's been the coordinator of the Diabetes Prevention Program and is also the mother of an 8-year-old with type 1 diabetes. So she's been there, done that with the diabetes management. Leslie Shallcross is also with me. She's an associate professor of Extension Youth Family and Community Development with the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Natural Resources and Extension. She also runs some diabetes prevention programs and has had 30 years experience in health promotion and disease prevention activities in the state. You can email questions to us during the next, we're going to be on about 25 minutes more. At line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. You can call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And always remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evening, you're listening to a taped recording, and we will not be able to take your calls or emails. I also like to remind everybody you can always get to our archives by going to alaskapublic.org and look for the Line 1 link so that you could ask somebody to listen to this program tomorrow or the next day or 2 weeks from now, or you could listen yourself if you wanted to. So, Aaron and Leslie, what came to my mind real quickly here is, now it left my mind. I was going to say something about, I know what it is. We've talked about diabetes, and before we get into these programs, I think it's when we've implied that it can be very subtle type 2 in developing, and we really didn't come out and say that there is a large percentage, there's a large number of people out there who actually have type 2 diabetes right now and undiagnosed. That's a consequence of not know of the subtlety of this and not getting the testing. And the testing is fairly easy. Most of these kinds of tests can be done at some of the health fairs that are done. You can ask your physician. So if you're older, overweight, having a lot of symptoms where you're not feeling so good, getting up at night, having to go to the bathroom a lot more, perhaps even losing weight, and particularly if you're overweight or have some cholesterol problems and so forth, it behooves you to perhaps look into whether or not you might have diabetes. Okay, so let's talk about
some other things that go along with diabetes, or high blood pressure and heart disease, and somebody may show up with those symptoms before they're diagnosed with the diabetes, but in fact, they have diabetes, and that is those elevated blood sugars are starting to cause other problems.
Yeah, that brings up a whole other issue. I will keep wanting to get to the prevention programs, but complications of diabetes are significant. And one of the reasons why we'd like to know that we've got diabetes is not just to save money, but we talked about heart disease. We talked about kidney failure is a significant issue. You have peripheral vascular and nervous system disease. So what I mean is you can start having, if you don't get good feeling in the bottom of your feet as you get older, you can have injury to your feet you're not aware of and get infections.
Blindness.
The small vessels in your eye can be affected by this, and it causes decreased vision over time. So there's significant what physicians call morbidity, complications, and side effects of these illnesses, as well as mortality, earlier death than expected for compared to other people your age is certainly a risk as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and it should be should be noted. You had asked about risk factors. It's definitely important for African American individuals, for Alaska Native and American Indians, for Asian Americans. Mm-hmm. All of these individuals have an even higher risk of developing diabetes. I had mentioned a risk factor that we talk about with prediabetes of a BMI over 25. For an Asian individual, the BMI of 22 is, which isn't very high, but that's high enough that we would be concerned that they are at a higher risk of developing diabetes.
I think so many of the public hear things like that and don't understand. What we're saying by that is statistically, your risk suddenly becomes excessive. What we don't want to do in medicine is cause it and give any disease, any cure or treatment that's worse than the disease. And so at certain levels, your risk is much higher than any treatment that we can give you. So that's kind of where these numbers come from. So Asian individuals, Black individuals have a little bit higher risk just genetically.
Yep. Hispanic and Latino. Hispanic.
Yes.
So that comes to a question that is forwarded to me by email. It says, what's the role in genetics? Can active, so what is the role of genetics in diabetes? And again, type 1 and type 2, which are a little different. But can active fit with normal height and weight proportion teenager get diabetes? I'm going to say certainly type 1 diabetes could easily happen there, but we do see very fit, normally appearing otherwise individuals who are not necessarily overweight develop type 2 diabetes, but not so common.
Yeah, usually, you said a teenager.
Yeah, this was a question. The general question was, what is the role of genetics in diabetes? And we've implied there are some racial and cultural or racial differences in.
I guess the thing that's a little frustrating, but it's also important to remember that we don't actually know the cause of type 2 diabetes, and it's probably multiple things. But what we do know about it is that lifestyle changes can take care of it, can help us, and it's very unlikely that a teenager would have type 2 diabetes. Teenager might develop reactive hypoglycemia and have blood sugars going up and down, but probably not diabetes.
I'm going to go ahead and take a couple more questions, and then we'll get back to the diabetes programs, which I think is very important. But since we got these emails.
Although we do see type 2 diabetes in younger and younger populations all the time, but as a rule, those people are going to be heavier than recommended.
The primary risk factor in the younger population appears to be overweight.
Right.
Let me see. This other question I had here was. A listener calls in and says, even with diet modifications, the hemoglobin A1C has not decreased. What's the explanation? So I assume this is hers. I can answer that. Do you guys want to answer why, with doing everything right, even more than diet, hemoglobin A1C may not decrease?
Well, physical activity is a huge part of that. It's not just changing how we eat and what we eat, but physical activity shows great benefits for people in dropping their A1C I've seen this in even people that I relate with, of where their diet was very consistent and very well, but the physical activity was minimal and scattered, if that. And then as he increased his physical activity more intensely and more intentively, his A1C dropped significantly over a couple months just from physical activity. So that's a big part of it.
So the way I think about this is, if your hemoglobin A1C is not decreased, by definition, your glucose is higher than it should be over the previous 3 months. So it's not that diet will solve all problems. And as you've mentioned, Aaron, exercise does increase the efficiency of insulin's ability to work. But you can reach a state where you can improve things, but you may never get things back to normal. So don't misunderstand where we are. I think it's fair to say, although I'm not even 100% sure of this, for most people, if you recognize it earlier, the more effective this is going to be. We're going to talk about the programs, diabetes prevention programs, but it turns out that lifestyle modification works even better than medications in almost in most people, or as good as in certain age groups, but certainly in the older individuals, the diet modification is even better. Doesn't mean you're going to get everything back to normal necessarily. So hopefully that helps you understand that question. One more question from an email. My sister's girlfriend was just diagnosed with pre-diabetes at 36. The doctor attributed some of her condition to the habits of waiting to eat food throughout the day, often skipping meals altogether. Any thoughts about that? Does the timing of eating, as far as you guys know, have any effect on hemoglobin A1C?
I'm
assuming the pre-diabetic was a hemoglobin A1C.
Sure.
I'm not sure something test was bothering them.
I have read studies about the way that people are eating and, you know, purging and binging and not eating has a significant thing to do with a weight gain, because it's inconsistent where people are, you know, not moving and eating particular foods at particular times, you know, and not eating for many hours you're almost starving your body. But as far as diabetes goes, no. Gain.
Yeah. My understanding is it may not be that. I mean, there's a lot when you get into it. We got the big factors down. It can be a little subtle. So you could argue about diets. There's high glycemic index foods like potatoes, which really jump up the amount of insulin produced for the same amount of food as some other particular food. So we could get a little bit picky at it, but I don't think in general it's probably as important as just general lifestyle changes, trying to get a hold of your weight, eat healthy, and exercise, and a couple other things.
Yeah,
I'm looking right across the table to a dietitian nutritionist, and I'm watching myself. I might get myself in deep trouble here.
No, not at all. I do think I'm sorry to hear that this person is being blamed for. We don't know what causes diabetes. Similarly, we don't know exactly what makes any one individual more or less susceptible to some of these things, like maybe eating one big meal a day and starving all the rest of the day. But as a rule, your metabolism is going to work better if you eat breakfast with some protein and have small balanced meals through the day. If you eat one big meal, or even if you kind of wait, you get hungry, you get cranky, you tend to overeat, and it's very hard to tell how have I had enough if you wait too long. So
I think it's a good point, Leslie, is we shouldn't be blaming ourselves or blaming somebody else about this. Okay, Bonnie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I know Aaron from the YMCA. Big shout out. Love the YMCA.
Hello.
Hi. We have just been really thankful. I had probably type 2 diabetes when I was pregnant. The first round had a giant baby, and then second round, I worked with a midwife who was really careful about what I was to eat. And that child has grown up to like a lot more of those healthy foods. And even that being said, when he got into school, it was so difficult because the other kids would be coming with cupcakes and all kinds of chips every day. And I was trying to send him healthy lunches, and he would come home and say, how come I get healthy food? How come I don't get a cupcake every day? And I've said it to her a long time ago, but I'll never forget. I was so thankful for Amy Schumacher, because Gus, her son, would come to school with like a whole pepper or carrots or vegetables. And it started to kind of become a cool thing, you know? And so all of a sudden overnight, my boys were coming home saying, yeah, we want to have more vegetables. We want to have more of this because this is cool now. And it, you know, no matter what I said, the power of that coming from the kids, they wanted that. They could see, oh, he's healthier. He can run faster. He can do these things. So they started to do it. And pretty shortly after, William got into biking. And so he's been doing the Tour de Cure. And they have just been really positive and supportive of William doing it. And even when it was hard for us to make our fundraising portion, they have supported that, even to where we have a friend who has a son who's really struggling with his weight. And she came to me and said, hey, I was wondering, I was thinking my son might be pre-diabetic. So I was thinking, could William go biking with him? And I thought, this is so awesome, because now William gets to be that kid for somebody else.
Very, very interesting and a wonderful story. Thanks very much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Yep.
Have a good day.
You too.
All right. So now we're at the stage of the program where we really want to hear about the prevention program. And it's, I want to say again, it's based on published data that shows that somewhere on the average is 7% weight loss. That's 14 pounds in a 200-pound person can significantly affect their diabetes and even prevent the onset of diabetes. And these programs are in town, and we have two individuals that are doing these programs. So let's hear about them. Erin, we haven't heard as much from you. So tell us about the why.
I don't have 30 years. She's amazing. Well, our programs are very similar. The YMCA has really just kind of tweaked it to be able to facilitate and run the programs out of the YMCA, although our program can also be offered to businesses in town. I can take the program to corporations and teach their employees if they are interested in that as well. So it is mobile, but it is a year-long program. Just as we had said before, and it is based off we start off with 16 weeks meeting in a classroom once a week, so it is a group setting. After the 16 weeks, we meet every other week three times, so those are the first 6 months, and then after those first 6 months, we meet once a month for the next 6 months, which are basically maintenance sessions. So when we are meeting, we are reviewing things. How are they doing? How are the tools that we have provided for them over the last 6 months? How are they utilizing those and functioning now on their own? A big encouragement that we do is to try to get them to take this on themselves, because this is their journey. And there's quite a bit of a support system within the group setting as well, too. And so we really try to focus on that they can encourage and spur each other on in class.
Is the program the YMCA uses modeled after, identical to the program that was in
yes.
the research we
yes,
talked about?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
So these are all coming down through the CDC.
Yes.
And passed on, and the state has picked them up and is helping support some of the program.
The goals are the same.
Okay.
The
yes.
goal for the those studies showed that, you know, 7 to 10% was enough to make a difference. And we know that, you know, it's enough to make a difference in blood pressure, mm-hmm. Can even mm-hmm. change your cholesterol a little if you mm-hmm. can get even small amounts of weight off. So the goals were that weight loss, yep. For people to increase their physical activity to 150 minutes
mm-hmm.
as a week,
yep.
as a minimum, also to keep food records.
Yes.
You know, keeping.
Which is their favorite thing to do.
Which is their least favorite thing to do.
mm-hmm.
And
it's much, I don't want to interfere, but it's much mm-hmm. easier to keep track of your foods and calories and intakes and fat than it ever has been.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of tools to use for that. Yeah. We provide that in the program.
Yes.
I mean, we provide a kind of quick and dirty food list for them.
Yeah.
Those are the things that are expected because those are things that have been demonstrated for many years to be really critical for weight loss and maintenance of weight loss.
And not only are we doing that, but we're focusing on the whole. My biggest word that I use is balanced lifestyle, not just a quick diet type of thing. So we really try to teach them how to deal with stress. Mm-hmm. How do you read food labels? Mm-hmm. How do you have food cues? I mean, or certain cues, you know, what do you think of when you go to a movie? What cue do you have there? Oh, yes, popcorn and treats and goodies, you know, what are certain things that trigger you to eat at different times? We talk about sleeping. We even start to introduce even carbohydrates and calories, having them research how many calories they should be intaking a day, depending on their lifestyle. We want to give them all these tools so that they can make really good choices, you know. So what do we do when we go to a Super Bowl party? How do we begin to balance our life when we're looking at all this food on the table, and what kind of choices do we need to make, and how do we make those choices, and why do we want to make those choices, and putting the big picture before them rather than just the mm-hmm. quick fix at the time. I think hearing people's success stories is really what spurs me on, I guess, is really starting to see them make those changes and balance their lifestyle and feel better overall in this process.
Why not just do a diet?
Why not just do a diet?
They don't work.
Yeah, they don't work.
They're temporary.
Well, there's very little evidence.
Yes, right.
Almost any diet you stick to within reason, I mean, there's some really crazy ones, will cause some weight loss. But what we're discovering is very few people who diet maintain that weight loss, is what, mm-hmm. what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that was the genesis of my question.
Many people say, oh, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. But if they don't actually keep track, which is what we ask them to do, mm-hmm. mostly they're not doing it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, what did you do that mm-hmm. made a difference? There's absolutely no way to do it and to figure out what you can change. What can I work on that I can actually change to make that difference, small difference in the number of calories that I'm taking in to help promote this this weight loss. It's a fairly moderate weight loss that we're asking. We're hoping that mm-hmm. they can do this within the first 16 weeks, but some people get there a little later.
Right. And really the goals that we're focusing on really go hand in hand in some ways. I mean, I just had a woman say, I'm surprised that I'm not losing weight. And so as we started to discuss in the group, one of the questions that came up was, well, which one of these things are you struggling most with? And her food had changed the way that she was eating, mm-hmm. but what she wasn't doing was having physical activity. So she had no physical activity to document. And so the light bulb kind of went on in the sense of, oh, well, I'm maintaining, which means if I add that physical activity in there, then I'm going to start to lose. And mm-hmm. so when their light bulb comes on, it's moments of change for them.
And I have some people in the program that I've been running who actually exercise quite a bit, but they're not losing weight because they really don't want to make changes in what they're eating.
Yep.
They find that just excruciating.
Yep.
So
it's a good balance. That's why
I like to. I see, teens and all the time that want to know why they can't lose weight with just exercise alone, and it always gets down to calories. And if mm-hmm. you burn up 300 calories walking for a couple of hours or something, you come home and eat a bagel, that's 300 calories. Now you're back to, the typical bagel nowadays is 300 calories roughly. So now you're back to energy balance. You haven't done anything. And the activity may be good for your heart. It may be good at helping insulin work a little bit better and everything. But as far as weight loss, it's by itself, exercise is pretty difficult. So often we just eat a little bit more.
We do give them a target of fat grams. Mm-hmm. One of the things, and it's pretty low. You know, and we do that not because all fat is bad, and I really stress to my groups that I want you to have good fat.
Yes.
If you're going to have fat, have good fat. Mm-hmm. But if they build their intake cutting out a lot of high fat foods, it's very easy to cut calories that way.
Because calories, twice as many calories in a gram of fat as there is in protein or sugar.
Yeah.
So people would not usually answer that question correctly, but that's where most of the bulk of calories can come from.
So we focus on that, and they get a ballpark, how many calories is right for me, and they start working with it. And really, it takes focus. It takes work. And that work is becoming self-aware. Mm-hmm. What am I doing, and why am I doing it?
Yeah.
When I reach for that candy bar, is it because my body needs it, or is it just because I'm reaching for it because I can taste it in my mouth before I get it?
And
we're in our last 7 minutes or so. I want to remind listeners again, if you've got questions about diabetes type 2 in particular, and some of the things you can do to prevent diabetes, give us a call, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Phone number again, 550-8433. So really what we know, if I go over this again, is that increasingly larger numbers of Americans, or actually everybody in the West, all over the developed countries, are becoming heavier. As a result, there's more diabetes, particularly type 2, and that we're learning that with early surveillance and recognition, we can affect that, and that we do that by controlling weight and increasing exercise. And the way this program goes about that is, I hate the term mindfulness, but it really is, as you put it, Leslie, what the big answer in this year-long thing is, changing how we think about food and exercise. And it's a lifestyle change, no matter how you look at it. Am I hungry? What am I going to do when I go to this party? How am I going to address the different things that are in front of me? How am I going to shop for groceries? How is that, what I shop for groceries, affect my temptation? How important is temptation in our eating habits?
So it's mindfulness.
Those are all the things. Mindfulness is just a little bit more, I don't know, ooshy-gooshy soft for me, but it's just, that's what we're talking about.
Right. Being balanced.
And that's one of the differences between what we're talking about in diet. When we, diet does change, but it's not this week's bestseller diet that we're not going to stick with. We're highly unlikely, despite the advertisement, to maintain long-term weight loss just on the dietary approach.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up, I know we're getting to the end, but people will find that this hemoglobin A1C is a test that they can get more often at health fairs. I recommend that they get it. Yeah. And the reason that I say that, if they have prediabetes, we talked about complications of diabetes, which are long. We didn't mention even all of them. But people with prediabetes have higher rates of those complications, too. Yeah. You may never develop diabetes, but if you have prediabetes, if your blood sugars are above normal, you have higher rates of dementia. You have, less cognitive function. You have higher rates of vascular disease, heart disease, high blood pressure, neuropathies, kidney problems. So prediabetes, although I don't like scary scary health promotion, disease prevention. Yeah. But I do think it's important for people not to ignore it. And I think it's important for doctors not to ignore it. A lot of times people tell me that they have high hemoglobin A1C, and I say, what did your medical provider say? Well, they didn't say anything. To me, that's not what needs to be said.
Sure.
To me, someone needs to say, that's a little risky, and time to start working on on lifestyle and diet.
In class, we even discuss the cost associated with diabetes that, you know, I mean, even just me addressing what it costs to help my type 1, it's amazing amount of money.
What are the costs for the program? We haven't really talked about it, and we haven't talked about how to get in touch with each of you or individuals that are interested. Let's make sure we do that real quickly.
Okay. Go ahead, Liz.
You know, at Extension, I have been offering the program, and it's a 12-month program, and I offer that for $240, and that covers a lot of the printing and materials that we need to provide to the participants.
Okay.
And our program is $429, and that includes a free YMCA membership that they can utilize for a year while they're in the program.
Right.
All right. I think we have a phone call. I want to take that one. Sam, you're on line one.
Yes. You want me to say my comment or question?
Yes, please.
Yes. When I was in the Army, I failed the first initial test, and they gave me a glucose tolerance test. Mm. And afterwards, they said that I had too much insulin. Mm-hmm. And they said that I would never have diabetes, and they said I probably would have a little bit more endurance, you know, when I was in the military, and they said there was no medical condition, and so I was drafted.
Wow.
But is that true?
I don't believe so.
I've never been tested afterwards.
I don't believe so. The testing for insulin may have improved since then. I don't believe that that's necessarily true. There probably are people who may make more insulin during periods of stress if they tested you after running or something. But I don't look at it as a positive. I don't know of any study that demonstrates that that's a positive benefit to have that.
Did they actually test your insulin level, or were they just saying that based on your blood glucose numbers?
They think they based it on a glucose tolerance test.
Just on the glucose numbers.
Yeah.
Mm. And they said that I had more, they concluded that I had more, that my body gave off more insulin.
Yeah, your glucose may have dropped excessively. It may have been just the opposite of diabetes then, where your glucose went lower because you were making more insulin.
And that's not a reason not to continue to get tested.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. If you still have other risk factors or problems, it's worth retesting that or getting a hemoglobin A1C. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks for your call,
Thanks,
Sam.
Sir.
You bet. We are in our last minute, and I got an email from a physician. Many of my patients, this is an ophthalmologist, I asked specifically what they can do to eat or reverse diabetic retinopathy. That's the small vessel disease of the retina with diabetes. There are a number of studies demonstrating a well-rounded foods, plant-based diet goes a long way to prevent, treat, and reverse type 2 diabetes. This is a diet recommended by Kaiser Permanente for all of their patients, whether diabetes or not. Does diabetes prevention program routinely advise patients to significantly eliminate or reduce animal fats or animal sources of protein? So does the diabetes prevention program recommend a change in animal fats? Do you know?
Well, we do. We, of course, talk about saturated fats with the caveat that we're not talking about eliminating all fats. Omega-3 fats are... I think I just read something about omega-3 fats and eye health. We know that they're good for the body in a lot of ways, and probably for eye health and maybe helping to prevent retinopathy.
Yeah.
All right, we've got to wrap it up. My thanks to Aaron Widener and Leslie Shallcross for taking the time to be with us today. If you want to continue the discussion on diabetes prevention programs, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to be talking about adolescent depression with Dr. Francis Mandemore of Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore, Maryland. Why not join us next Monday at 2 p.m.? Dave Waldron, audio engineer, today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.